This podcast series is brought to you with the kind support of Darwin Alternative Investment Management Limited, which offers innovative, alpha-driven investment solutions that are uncorrelated with traditional asset classes and feature business areas which have not previously been considered by investment funds. The firm aims to create new opportunities for investors to further diversify their portfolios and achieve stable, absolute returns.
There's a playwriting analogy I love. There's a woman in Stanford University Center for Longevity, a woman called Professor Laura Carstensen, who uses this analogy, and I love it. Imagine you've written a 75-minute play. Hopefully, the obvious analogy here being a minute of that play is equivalent to a year of your life. So you've written this life, you've written this 75-minute play, and along comes the producer, and she says to you, do you know what? You can have another 15 minutes. You can have another 20 minutes. What would you do as the author of your play? Would you just stick another 15 or 20 minutes on to the final scene and let it kind of spin out? Because I kind of think that's really how we're approaching these longer lives culturally at the moment. Or would you actually look back at your whole plot, your whole story, and think about, oh, I might put an extra minute there, I might put an extra 5 minutes there, I might think about my act one, my act two, not just my act three? Of course you'd do the latter, wouldn't you? You'd think about making that whole story deeper and different and richer and more rewarding. And that's how we need to think, I think, about longer lives.
I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today by Catherine Foote, who is director at Phoenix Insights, a new longevity think tank launched in 2021, which reimagines how we work, learn, save, and live in an age of longer lives. She previously was director of evidence at the Center for Aging Better, and prior to that was assistant director of policy at the King's Fund. Welcome, Catherine. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Ethan. It's really lovely to be here.
Start with your background and career journey. Can you just first tell us where you grew up, what you studied, and the topics you first focused on in your roles in social policy at the beginning of your career?
Sure, I'd love to. Yes, it strikes me that there's lots of ways in which I'm perhaps not an example of a particularly diverse member of the financial services industry, in that I'm, you know, white and privileged and middle class and grew up in the southeast of England. But I guess my career history moving into financial services after decades in the not-for-profit and charity sector is probably where I had a diversity of thinking to some extent at least. But yes, so I grew up in the edges of London, in northwest London, in metro lands, great expanses of suburbia that grew up in the early decades of the 20th century, and studied history at university in that wonderfully luxurious time in the late 90s, when if you got a place at a good university, you could pretty much pick your favourite A-level and knew that you were going to get a decent job at the end of it. You know, we'll retire future generations, my children among them, who will not have that same luxurious jobs market, I think, ahead of them when they make their degree choices. But yeah, I did history, my favourite A-level at the time, and then looked really at the charity sector as I was graduating, very sort of clear in my mind that I wanted a role that had a very, very direct contribution to improving the lot of the people that needed help in society. That's probably how I used to think about it around then. And there was one charity in particular with an incredibly outdated name that's since changed. They were called the Imperial Cancer Research Fund. Can't believe they still had Imperial in there. In their title, really, in like this was 2000, they're now Cancer Research UK, and they were one of the very, very few charities at that time who were really explicitly offering a program for graduates where they would take you around different departments and you would begin over a couple of years to learn how big charities in the UK operated and how they did what they did and where your skills and interests might fit. So it was a fabulous opportunity, and that's where I started. From there, really moved into health policy more specifically. This was a time in Westminster in the UK government policy where there was a lot of money being thrown at the health service to tackle big problems in waiting times for operations, waiting times for diagnoses. There was a lot of money going into the cancer system at the time. And I helped that charity set up a function that would enable it to have an opinion about government policy and to do the sorts of policy research and analysis that would enable it to influence government thinking at the time. So it was quite a broad role, thinking really broadly about health services and how they were working in particular for cancer patients. That's where I started.
And the interest in aging there, I can see that health policy, social policy, aging is sort of integral to much of that. But how did that develop in particular?
Well, when I was at university, I volunteered at a local nursing home. So I suppose actually that my interest in aging wasn't just fostered there, but it must have predated it in that, you know, why did I make that choice to volunteer in a nursing home? I don't really remember. But when I did, I made some friends amongst the residents. We ran a music club every Sunday. We got these amazing student musicians in to play, you know, beautiful a cappella groups, harp, violin, you know, you name it, every Sunday for the residents. And I made some friends and, you know, a few stories really, but one in particular, perhaps I might mention a lady who wasn't called Anne, but let me call her Anne in out of respect. I won't tell you what she was really called, but she'd been there for, gosh, I think it must have been 15 years in this home. Longer there than she'd been in her previous home. She'd been widowed for as long as she'd ever been married. She'd been retired for about 25 years. And she was sitting in this home telling me that she'd never really, since she'd moved there, made a friend. And I don't know, my very sort of patronizing 19-year-old way, I just felt deeply, deeply sorry on her behalf. And it really made me think, this extraordinary gift of longer lives that, you know, decades of advances in public health, in science and nutrition have given us. Is this really all we do with them? Is this all really all we enable people to do with them? Are we not just collectively giving up on ourselves far too early? And shouldn't we do things quite differently? I suppose that's where my interest began. I wasn't able then to get a job immediately speaking to that purpose. That came a little bit later in my career. But really my interest in how we as a society treat and support all of ourselves throughout our whole lives, but particularly as we get older, to be, you know, full and active members of society, contributing and enjoying our lives for the whole length in which we can now enjoy them, started, yeah, way back then.
So interesting. I love that concept of collectively giving up on ourselves as something to work against, shall I say, because it does seem that that occurs sometimes. And then the Centre for Aging Better. So can you tell us how you took some of these concepts forward then there
and
what that worked on?
Absolutely. So just in the sort of midst of what was the coalition government, this was about 2013 or so, the House of Lords had a select committee inquiry into Is Britain Ready for Ageing? To which, as I'm sure you can imagine, the answer was a resounding kind of no at pretty much every level. And governments are required to respond to House of Lords Select Committee inquiries. And some bright spark somewhere in the middle of the Cabinet Office had the idea of setting up a new charitably endowed centre of evidence to think about how do we respond to an ageing population. So that's what the Centre for Ageing Better was and where its genesis began. And I was its first director of evidence. So we set about thinking about what's known already about what we need to do differently about ageing. How could we add to that evidence base, and how could we use that evidence in partnership with local government, with central government, with employers to make some of the changes that we know are so urgently needed? And that's where, in particular, I began to work and become very interested in issues of working life and employment and what the issues were for people falling out of work far too early, not being able to get back into work. And I became very aware that, you know, in some parts of the corridors of Whitehall and Westminster, the government's principal response to our ageing population was just to incrementally increase the age at which people could access the state pension, making that state pension system immediately more affordable to the public finances. But that then state pension age was creeping ever further away from the age at which perhaps the people who arguably needed it most were falling out of work and not managing to get back in again. So it was through working at the Centre for Ageing Better that I particularly began to work on issues of employment, of poverty and pensions.
And if you were to say there were any one or two major things that we are missing, getting wrong and could do better, maybe some kind of easy fixes and maybe some less easy fixes, if there are any easy fixes, what would you say you focus on in terms of issues that we need to think more about?
Well, I would say The first of those, perhaps, I mean, I guess in no particular order, but one really important one is this issue of working life and of if we're going to be living for, you know, 80, 90, 100 years, as many as one in three children born today are likely to live to 100, we really need to start thinking about the length of our working life and how we can sustain meaningful, fulfilling, rewarding financially and in other ways work for longer. A world where everybody retires in their mid-60s. It is still not a world that we live in, as I say. You know, employment rates for people younger than that in their 50s and 60s in the Northeast are way below that. Better, of course, in richer parts of the country like the Southeast. Huge sort of regional inequalities there. But we're not really yet enabling people to remain in fulfilling work for long enough. And that's such a kind of lose-lose-lose situation we exist in at the moment, in that, you know, it doesn't work for the individuals who lose their ability to earn and save for their futures and lose connection and fulfillment in many ways. It doesn't work for businesses who in this country are sitting in this very tight labour market with basically about a million vacancies people aren't able to fill. And it doesn't work for UK PLC, if you like. We're not remotely making the most of this wealth of human capital that we, you know, could be enjoying in this country. So I would say employment's a really big one, and very closely related to that. Another, of course, is savings and pensions. You know, in a world where defined benefit, final salary pensions are increasingly a rarity, where the generosity of workplace pensions has significantly declined, and where, as I say, the state pension age is ever incrementally creeping away from us, most people in the UK are not on track for decent retirement incomes. Only 14% of DC savers in our modelling look like they're on track for the retirement incomes they want. And I don't think, you know, this quite the scale of that problem has yet really hit home. I think most of us look to our parents or grandparents even to imagine our own retirements and can see very sort of comfortable and secure existence even for people on, you know, on lower incomes. But in a world where access to the housing market is much, much harder, of course, and a world where pensions are much less generous and don't come with that guarantee of an income for life anymore, financial precarity in retirement is a huge kind of looming issue we're facing in Britain and not yet really tackling.
And the word reimagining is something we used a lot when we chatted first. And maybe we can tie this to the work in Phoenix Insights now, because you're reimagining how we work, learn, save and live, or how we will in the future. Can you talk a little bit about how we should rethink those?
I suppose what's really important to me is to be thinking about these longer lives very much over the course of the entirety of that longer life rather than just the years at the end. There's a playwriting analogy I love for this. There's a woman in Stanford University Center for Longevity, a woman called Professor Laura Carstensen, who uses this analogy, and I love it. Imagine you've written a 75-minute play. Hopefully the obvious analogy here being a minute of that play is equivalent to a year of your life. So you've written this life, you've written this 75-minute play, and along comes the producer and she says to you, do you know what, you can have another 15 minutes, you can have another 20 minutes. What would you do as the author of your play? Would you just stick another 15 or 20 minutes onto the final scene and let it kind of spin out? Because I kind of think that's really how we're approaching these longer lives culturally at the moment. Or would you actually look back at your whole plot, your whole story, and think about, oh, I might put an extra minute there, I might put an extra 5 minutes there, I might think about my act one, my act two, not just my act three. Of course you'd do the latter, wouldn't you? You'd think about making that whole story deeper and different and richer and more rewarding. And that's how we need to think, I think, about longer lives. So when I rather, you know, grandiosely claim I'm sort of reimagining longer lives, that's what I mean, I suppose, really. I mean, thinking differently about our expectations for when we learn, for example, when we study, when we retrain and upskill, when we work, when we lean in and lean out of work over these much longer lives, and when we, you know, rest and play, when we have our leisure. It's been said by many in the longevity space that I sort of spend a lot of my time in before, but that traditional and very male three-stage life of all your study, then lots of full-time work, and then lots of full-time leisure at the end. is not a three stages that makes sense for many of us in the 21st century for lives at the length that we can live now. So it's about really thinking, I guess, about what we do when and reimagining what's normal and what's appropriate and what's sort of a sensible use of our now many, many more hours on the planet.
I love that analogy. And I think we could go many directions with that. We could have more plot twists. We could have more character development. There's definitely more relationships, more themes even bring into that longer play. And was the work around Phoenix Insights in particular. Can you talk about that? Because I know that job change is something that you've been passionate about, the potential to have it, how to make it happen, how to make it successful, how to think about reskilling.
Yes.
How do those come into this longer life concept?
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple of years ago now, I was sat very much enjoying my role at the Centre for Ageing Better with, you know, lots of really exciting work and potential there when Phoenix Group came knocking, UK's largest pensions and savings business, really interested in what we were doing and in the idea of setting up a longevity think tank, as they put it. Really an opportunity, as I saw it, though, to do what I was trying to do in terms of catalysing social change, but try and do it from inside a big FTSE 100 in the financial services industry. And I just thought, what an interesting proposition, and not one coming from this long history that I had in charities and think tanks, that's often afforded somebody with that background to kind of make that shift into the private sector. And so I obviously, you know, had to play it very cool in the recruitment process. Oh, you know, I might be interested in Phoenix. Let's talk. But I, you know, I was sitting on my hands. I couldn't wait to get involved. And so we call it Phoenix Insights, a longevity think tank. But essentially, the way I think about it is it's a project trying to achieve social change from inside a FTSE 100 company and trying to use the levers of that company and partnerships within it to maximize the positive difference that we can make for people in British society who are faced living these longer lives in these structures that don't work for them. And so, as I said before, employment's a big theme and a big part of that. And you're absolutely right that I think, you know, one area when I set up Phoenix Insights, I spent 6 months going around the country running groups with the general public, trying to kind of test this play analogy, if you like, test this idea of you're going to live for longer. What do you want to do with it? What's working for you and what's not working for you? And the area, you know, you name it, from whatever walk of life, rich, poor, black, white, north, south, where people felt most energized was, and most sort of positive about the opportunity of longer lives, was really this idea that maybe midlife was not the beginning of a home straight in a job you perhaps didn't enjoy all that much, but felt you needed to just sort of run out the clock with until you could finally relax and retire and do something that you wanted to do. Because part, not least, because people were realizing that moment of retirement and being able to afford it was probably creeping ever further away. But instead of that, maybe midlife was a time where actually you could still have time to be somebody else, to do something else, to use your skills and experience and talents and think, well, where could I take them and what could they do for me in this next phase of my life? And so I became interested in taking that further with people, and we began to explore this idea of careers can change. And so Phoenix Insights launched a campaign with that name just earlier this year, really hoping to inspire, if you like, a generation of people in midlife that different is possible and that there is great support out there freely available, as well as stuff you can pay for if you can afford it, to help you think about your skills, your interests, jobs that might work for you. Perhaps, for example, you're in an industry where you're worried maybe your job's not going to exist in 5 years' time. Or, as I've already described, you're just in a job that your levels of satisfaction are just going down and down in. And you know you want to do something different, but it just feels too risky. It feels too difficult. It feels expensive. It feels scary. And it doesn't feel normal. It feels like a midlife crisis, not a really proactive and sensible decision for longer lives. So those are some of the conversations we're trying to have with people. And those are some of the connections we're trying to build between people who might see career change as a means of enabling them to work more sustainably for longer, and the sorts of support that's already out there that could really help them make what, as I say, can feel like a big leap at that time of life.
And beyond career change, that campaign has launched, I know, on the UK national press. I wrote to you just when it caught my attention just a few weeks ago. What's the response to that broader campaign beyond even career change, but just around talking about aging better? How has that been received?
It's been really positive. Yes. So what you're referring to is some big brand campaigns that we've been helping Phoenix Group deliver. Really, I think it's a company that is keen to come out, if you like, of its sort of shadowy holding company status that nobody except investors have ever really heard of, and begin to kind of be a company that the general public have started to hear of and be aware of. And so this sort of campaign activity is really important for that. And I'm delighted that where we've landed in terms of how we want to go about approaching raising awareness of Phoenix, the company, is absolutely hand in hand with this space of raising awareness of longer lives and the opportunity that they present. We've had some just fantastic reactions. You know, social media is an extraordinary thing, isn't it? To get this sort of instant feedback and endless kind of long and short and everything in between comments and conversations prompted. And I think, you know, it's early days. And if you come from a background of working in social policy change, you know, every man and his dog wants to kind of prompt a national conversation about the thing that they care so much about and raise public awareness of this thing that desperately needs to be tackled or be reacted to. And I'm, you know, I'm just one of those. I'm in that camp trying to do this about longer lives and their opportunities. So I think it's early days. But as I say, I think particularly this idea around, you know, it's not too late, actually, and different is possible, are the sorts of ideas that are beginning to really resonate with people.
And just on the topic of continuous learning and reskilling, later we'll be having a podcast with discussing the micro-credentials, which are now getting more awareness across universities, targeting midlife professionals with a view to reskilling. And not only is that a great opportunity for them to change career, but it's also a great reinvention of the university and its purpose. So lots to talk about there.
Really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. So just the last question is around, I suppose, diversity and inclusion, particularly maybe talking about ageism, because all of these policy changes are fantastic and clearly well needed. But we do have some kind of ingrained ways of thinking and biases, et cetera, perhaps in the workplace. How have you seen the workplace change to recognize perhaps the potential of older workers? Do you think ageism is still an issue?
I think it's still a huge issue. I think it's so deeply ingrained in our society, isn't it? You know, it's so normal to be ageist in our everyday language. You take a phrase like, you know, you don't look your age. That's just totally normal and okay to say, isn't it? Imagine saying the sort of equivalent statement to somebody who's gay, you know, oh, wow, you know, you look really straight today. Good for you. What's your secret? That's not okay, is it? And yet for age, it is. So I think there's a huge mountain to climb, honestly, to be challenging our conceptions of, you know, how we think about getting older and the course of a life. I would say I've seen, you know, a really growing movement, and I'm delighted that organisations like the Centre for Ageing Better, my former home, are leading the charge in that regard. But I think it's still a huge issue. And, you know, we know that these attitudes to age and getting older directly affect something as extraordinary as people's life chances and people's life expectancy. You might be aware of some of the data from these big longitudinal studies that follow people over the course of their whole lives and track different aspects of their sort of psychology and their attitudes and their experiences in, you know, in society, in the economy, and really follow the complexity of people's lives over decades. And those sorts of longitudinal studies have shown really clearly that people with really negative attitudes to getting older are likely to live less long, and that you can, you know, make some extraordinary differences in your health and in your well-being and even in your life expectancy if you're able to take a more positive outlook on age and aging. I think, you know, I've seen in the last few years a lot of companies profess an interest in recruiting older workers, which is fabulous. I still think that we've seen in the labour market data most recently, you know, really big problems with people falling out of work in this sort of 50 plus camp. And the longer you fall out of work, the harder it becomes to get back in. So I still think there's an awful lot to do around how companies attract older workers, how they advertise, the words they use, the ways they try to reach people, really giving an impression for people who, you know, might have lost confidence, as we know workers do at all ages when they left the workforce for any length of time. They're wanted, they're genuinely desired, that their skills are respected and being sought after by these businesses. So I think we're early days, I think, in really grasping the opportunities of our aging workforce. And I think there are some big, deep cultural tides that run against this in our own kind of, as I say, everyday language and cultural attitudes that will make that not an easy journey. But all I hope, you know, I can do at Phoenix and we can do as a company is show what we're doing as an employer and the difference that we're making through our research and our public campaigns in Phoenix Insights, try and chip away at this tide and try and demonstrate the benefits that older workers can bring and how it really is, as I said, solving this, you know, such a win-win-win for individuals, for businesses and the economy.
It's so interesting because I think probably you mentioned that the old narratives that used to kind of stick, you know, around this three-part life, a career. And I think there was also a belief, maybe certainly when I was younger, that, you know, your life not only was your security, a singularly upright financial security and upward trend, maybe that your competence would always be kind of just consolidating. And I think what we're now realizing is those lines are not like upward, like a hockey stick, but they're a lot more, I suppose, undulating throughout our lives, and that we may need confidence boosts in our 50s, 60s, and we may need financial security boosts. And we may Absolutely. Need any kind of skilling in terms of competence. So I think really the dynamic nature of it never being essentially done is just so important to remind ourselves of. Let's move to some personal reflections. So you've had this career in policy that has taken on many different forms. Would you say there were any highs or lows in terms of achievements and breakthroughs maybe there that you can speak about?
Earlier in my career, one thing that I was young and I was only sort of tangentially a part of it. But, you know, I was really privileged to be, you know, a small part and be close to the movement that achieved the smoking ban, that achieved the ban on smoking in public places and workplaces in the UK in the kind of early 2000s. And I think what I saw over that period was how actually it's genuinely possible to take something that feels normal, but that you know isn't in anybody's interest, smoky pubs, smoking everywhere, and shift cultural attitudes and work with people so that you actually change how we think, and that it became not okay to smoke around other people, not okay to smoke indoors. And you can actually achieve that with, of course, you know, decades of research and huge investment and coordination and lobbying and pressure groups of doctors, of scientists, you know, you name it. But you can actually achieve those sorts of changes. So I suppose that's given me a great sense of optimism that some of the things that I now care so much about and work on, about how we think differently about our longer lives and how we approach work and saving, we're not stuck with the attitudes we've got at the moment. We can change them.
And one of the things we do associate with old age, which I don't think actually is a bias or a trope, is around wisdom. We've got another podcast in this series that specifically talks about the scientific basis for older age wisdom. But I'm sure in your encounters, you have encountered quite a bit of wisdom, creeds, mottos, words of advice. Was there anything that you've heard that made an impact on you that you say you live by today?
Gosh. What a good question. I mean, I suppose I feel very clear about my professional purpose, if you like. Not really a motto, but this idea, you know, as described in that playwriting analogy we talked about earlier, this idea that living for 100 just means restructuring the whole of our lives and thinking very differently about when we work, when we learn, when we earn, when we save, when we rest and play, and how urgent I consider that agenda to be, but how transformative it could be for inequalities in this country, for, as I say, maximising our human potential. So it's not really a creed or a motto, but it's certainly the ambition I live by.
Well, it is a deep driver. I've really enjoyed this conversation because as someone myself, I tend to embrace change. And I noticed that for a lot of people, there's a sort of defeatism that comes with change or a sense that it's not possible. I think you have reminded us that it is possible. And not only is it possible, but just the massive potential that it has for people to create and enjoy rich lives. And I think our conversation has shown that that's not just rich in the financial sense, but also in the sense of having purpose and deep and meaningful relationships right through the end of one's life. So thank you so much, Catherine, for raising awareness of that, for the passion you've had for this your entire career, and the work you're doing now at Phoenix and beyond to raise awareness of that on a national level. I appreciate you coming here and sharing your insights with us.
Oh, it's been a total pleasure chatting with you. And I know that, you know, you and I share absolutely these sorts of ideas and missions. So it's been absolute delight to chat with you today. Thank you so, so much for having me.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear from more inspiring professionals and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.